colonial project, that this is Zionism is in many ways a death cult, which only strives for the complete ethnic cleansing of a land in order to establish and supplant basically an entirely new population on it, much like what has happened in the establishment of the United States and Australia, for which reason, again, another reason for the United States and Australia to support this project, because for them, for these governments, this is very familiar. This is how their country came to be. But for many people now, you can see what is going on. You can see what is happening. And you see a lot of people nowadays, all over the political spectrum, even in the West itself, people who are left-wing, people who are right-wing, who are rising up now against what they see as a fundamental perversion of international law, of international justice, and also what they see nowadays, more and more people start to wake up to the fact that the national sovereignty of their own country is in many ways being subverted by politicians who dare not speak out for fear of their career, for fear of losing their funding, for fear of committing political suicide. And this is something that a lot of people have starting to understand now, that this is a conflict that is bigger than just one strip of land in Palestine, one strip of land in West Asia. This is an international concept. This is an international struggle against a group of people who believe, in this case the Zionists, who believe that people and have the right to do whatever they want, to get whatever project done and whatever goals met that they want to, and kill anyone they want along the way and break every international norm and every international law they want while trying to get to the goal that they want to achieve. More and more people are starting to understand that this is completely unjustified. You see people rising up in the United States, even in the United Kingdom, people who are not just Muslims, but Christians, even Jews, people who are non-religious, people who are religions and backgrounds, who are starting to rise up and to say and to understand and to say and to voice their opinion that this is an unjustifiable system and that this can no longer go on this way and that Zionism needs to end in order for some amount of peace to finally have a chance in the region.
Well, Nick, I mean, in this world where the entity which continually goes against international law and kills civilians at will and in prison without trial does not have to pay a price, and the ones who defend the oppressed are punished, do you think that it is showing people more and more that there is no other option except resistance? You cannot rely on the international organizations, for example, the United Nations, the Geneva Conventions. None of that really has any type of meaning, unfortunately, in this world today. Do you think more and more people are realizing that resistance is the only way, and also looking at the success of the resistance and maybe for themselves also, that this is a sample of direction that they too can go into to resist?
You know, our friend pointed to the value of social media as opposed to what we call the mainstream media. It's extremely disciplined in America and Britain and so on, what people are allowed to learn about. There's real strong and very disciplined management of the news. Despite that, large numbers of people are now outside the control by elites, which has lasted until now. Politics is extremely turbulent. I mean, a sort of pathological example of this is Trump. But it means that people who used to vote in a traditional way for a traditional party are much more the system is much more unstable than it was. People are beginning to be very angry indeed. Part of that is undoubtedly opposition to foreign wars, to aggression by our governments in the Middle East. I just point out, by the way, along as a monster, Donald Trump, when he first ran for the presidency, he was very critical of Israel. He was very critical of USAID that went to Israel. Now, he changed his tune very quickly in order to get the billionaires' money from the likes of Sheldon Adelson and so on. But when he criticized Israel, it didn't do him any harm at all when he was beginning to rise in the polls. Israel is, because of Palestinian resistance, because of Lebanese resistance, Israel is already, and it's so important to bear this in mind, a pariah state in the eyes of public opinion. That has been remarkably consistent since the EU apologized to Israel for the opinions of its own citizens vis-a-vis Israel. It's simply got better from our point of view and worse from the Israeli point of view.
All right. How, and unfortunately, so sorry to interrupt you, Mick, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mika Nepia out of Edinburgh. Historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Halsund. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and my dear guest in the studio, sitting with me here in the studio, Brother Habib and Brother Mahdi. Assalamu alaikum to both of you. First, let me start with you.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much, Brother Habib, at your service. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you guys.
Thank you very much. And Brother Mahdi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Mahdi, and I'm really glad to be here with you guys, inshallah.
My pleasure.
Enjoy this night.
Thank you very much. In these series of programs, we are, in fact, delving into some issues, and we hope and expect you, in fact, to contribute as much as you can to the topics that are raised, usually. So one of the topics that we're going to touch on is COVID-19, and I think you guys, both of you, Brother Habib and Brother Mahdi, agree with me to some extent that life before COVID-19 and life after it was not comparable at all. Brother Mahdi, let me start with you. Do you agree?
Of course, I think COVID-19 was a turning point in the life of so many people in the world, especially those who got directly affected and those who got infected by the COVID itself. Mm. Not only because their jobs changed, not only because they lost dear ones, but also everything. Now, if you look at the pictures of 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and no one has a face mask on, you feel butterflies in your stomach, like, yes. You're like, what is going on?
Yes.
So I think the life of so many people have obviously and so clearly changed.
Mm-hmm.
And affected by this COVID-19.
Okay, Brother Habib, do you think, is there any connection between COVID-19 and religious identity?
I think that religion is a lifestyle at the end of the day. It's your life. It's your path, your way of life, the way you conduct every action. So yes, of course, it did affect many people's religion, some of them to the better, some to the worse, and some of them, no, really didn't change that much.
I see.
That's all I have to talk about that. Your question. That's the answer to your question.
But the thing is, when we are talking about the religious identity, lots of those conceptions that people had in their mind, you know, have been, in fact, subjected to change because of COVID-19. They sort of think, or they used to think, that some of the ideas that they had in mind were somehow religious, and now that because of the COVID-19, they can't do a lot of those, let's say, religious, for example, services and ceremonies. So they feel somehow empty inside, or they think that they have lost, for example, some portion of their religious identity.
I'm talking on a personal level. Unfortunately, for the show's sake, fortunately for me, I live with people who really didn't care about Corona.
Okay.
And all of us had Corona. We got infected with it. Don't be worried about us.
And you were lucky that you survived, because lots of people did.
Let me ask you a personal question. I've got vaccinated.
Yes, I have. Okay. Iranian vaccination as well. Yes, I did.
Barakat.
I'm proud of it. Yes, barakat. I think I really didn't lose it that much. It was more the opposite. The more that I saw people less in the ceremonies, the more that I had a burn to go myself and to encourage people to go. Now, I was always in this debate, whether we should be making these gatherings or not, whether visiting the grave of Sayyidi Masuma alayhi salam here in Qom should be allowed or disallowed. I was not in the participation when they closed the doors. I was against that. I was against both parties at the time. I used to go visit every day. The grave was empty during the days of COVID. Yes, I did not get COVID at that time. When did I get COVID? When you guys closed Haram. Anyway, now, I believe...
How do you connect the two?
Huh?
For the sake of the argument.
How do you connect the two, man? You have to be smart like me.
You got it from another gathering. It doesn't mean that it's related to the closing of the door.
No, but I think the religious identity, what happens, I think your question is really important because one of my friends is teaching crisis management in University of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that, the city of Toronto is such a multicultural city.
Yes.
It has populations. Exactly. It has population. Chinese.
Korean, African, Asian,
Iran, Persian. Like
it's a melting pot.
Lebanese, exactly. Yeah. Like it's a big mega city that has all these different people. Yes. And different cultures react differently in the times of crisis. So his thesis was a studying on how would people interact or react to an earthquake in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chinese would, react differently. The Iranians would react differently, mm-hmm. and that will add to the crisis. So managing that crisis becomes differently.
Yes.
Religion, we all believe, is a path to, is a lifestyle, mm-hmm. is a program for living,
yes.
right? Is a set of rules that will hopefully make us better human beings.
Yes.
Would elevate the quality of life of this dunya, this world, and hereafter. That's yes. what we believe religion is. Therefore, religion mm-hmm. should not be respondless when it comes to a crisis, a test, a tribulation like COVID, right? So I think the religious identity definitely shaped our reaction to the COVID. Many of people said at the very beginning, and I think I was wrong, they said, if you step into a sacred vicinity, the shrine of Lady Fatima, Masuma, Salam alayha, peace be upon her, the shrine of Imam Ridha, or elsewhere, if you step into that place, then there's no COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And then you saw many of the examples on the contrary that people had COVID or got COVID, which is fine. I mean, there was something that I call it complex ignorance, jahl muqaddas. Sacred ignorance. Why? I believe, I have a certain belief that the COVID is not at a certain place.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the rational protocols that have been set and that have been discovered will be ignored by a certain number of people.
Exactly.
On the claim of that this sacred place does not have a COVID. Well, that I believe is a sacred ignorance. Is an ignorance that is complex and has a tune or has a color or cover of religion and belief into it. And that becomes really hard to debate over.
Yes.
Because that thing, that idea has become a belief inside of the heart.
So to make it more clear, look, I'm not going to defend them completely because I have my own separate view about Corona, for example, and visiting the graves of the Imam alayhi salam.
All right.
I disagree with closing down the shrines too.
Good. So we might agree. But I just want to make them... put them in defense. See, I'm not talking about the information is correct or not, but such examples, you know, the guy that licked the grave,
yes,
and was put on the newspaper.
His shrine.
I know him. Personally, I know him. I know him. Who he is, where he lives, what he is, what he works as. I know where he goes. The thing is that...
The video of that person went viral, by the way.
He was in the newspapers in Turkey.
Yeah.
But he went to the president of Iran and asked for his forgiveness. Anyway...
If he had said the hadith of Ahlul Bayt, no one would have watched it.
Yeah. I sat down with him. I talked to him. I told him, why did you do that? He said, you guys from Hawza, you guys teach us this. إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهِ يَطَهِرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا First of all. Second of all, there's sayings that are available that if ذِكْرُ أَهْلِ الْبَيْتِ شِفَاءٌ مِنَ الْوَعْقِ You know what the waq is, you know, high fever. So it's a shifa, or it's a cure for high fever. For diseases, just remember the remembrance of Ahlul Bayt. So they have this belief in them. So they're not coming from, you know, jahl mutlaq, you know, total and absolute ignorance. They might be coming from misunderstanding. Not from their, it's not their fault. It goes to a higher level fault. It goes to the faults of us khutaba, us lecturers, us yes. students in Hawza. It goes back to them, right? this misinformation that we used to always accept on the pit bulls of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and no one used to come and say that you're saying it wrong, you're doing this. And if you used to say it, what would they do? They would say that you're against the majalis of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Now, see, this is an example.
You've been labeled with kufr.
Yes, yes, exactly. That's the thing. So what you're trying to say that they have, you know, jahli muqaddas, I don't know if you call it, but what I want to say is that it's not a mutlaq jahl. It's not an absolute ignorance. It's ignorance coming from misinformation. That's one thing.
You mean they got it from a source.
They got it from a source. But the they source was,
twisted
not,
it yes, one way or another.
Yes. What I personally believe is that, no, Corona is available.
But also, I mean, it's not only just getting it from a source, but we human beings always search for our comfort zone,
yes,
for simplifying complexities, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the times, when we're faced with something that is complex.
I don't know if you've noticed it, but most of the unfortunate lecturers, what do they do? That's their goal. They don't care if they're saying something right or not. They want to create a comfort zone. When they create this comfort zone, anything that puts the people in this comfort zone, that really just magnetizes people towards them, attracts people towards them, they will say it. That comfort zone is not always given birth from me or from that individual. Sometimes that comfort zone, it comes from society, it comes from the community that he's living in. So it's not always their fault. That's what I want to say. So the reason why I'm saying this is that the listeners won't always say like, oh yeah, of course, they're so stupid, they don't understand. No, what I want to say is that no, there's a rationality behind it. That's what I wanted to say.
Of course there's a rationality behind it. Those people are not mindless. What I'm saying is that those people who came, that might be a bit off topic, but let me say it. Those people who came to Karbala and confronted Imam al-Hussein, some of them did not think that Imam al-Hussein is a good person.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them really thought that they're doing a good deed, fighting against a person.
Yes, that was the Umayyad propaganda that was,
yes,
available.
Who has
exactly,
posed
because
a
of the
threat
propaganda,
to,
yeah.
Exactly, who has posed a threat to the national security. And they said, we are doing it for the sake of
exactly,
God.
Exactly, that's why they were so happy in Sham. They were calling them Khawarij.
So yes, there is a rationality, but I mean, rationality itself is not absolute, right? It's not complete.
Rationality plus the availability, you know, what they think is rationality plus pureness.
What we believe in Islam is that rationality plus divine guidance is what that
exactly,
leads us
exactly,
to
true,
perfection.
True, 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 true,
not
true,
just
true,
absolute
true,
rationality,
true, true,
not only
exactly,
absolute.
I'm with you. But yeah, what I want to say is that, you know, the manner that some people may hear is because we have come without no claim. They have no claims. They do have claims. They do have their own claims.
There's an ideology,
and there is
it,
someone
definitely,
who was at fault of it.
Yeah, that's simplifying the complexity of
okay,
the matter. Yeah.
Okay, guys, let me ask you quite related question.
Brother Mahajawad is feeling left out.
Yeah. You didn't ask us about, you know, our personal view about, for example, Corona visiting the graves of the Imam alayhi salam. Well, you said you had a personal view.
Definitely.
What's your personal view?
I'm
intrigued to know.
Well, I believe that. I think visiting the shrines of Ahlul Bayt, visiting, going to masjid is a necessity. The same way going to bank, going to purchase groceries, all of these are necessary, right? You can't live without having food. You can't live without running transactions in your bank accounts. And I cannot live without visiting the shrines of Ahlul Bayt. So that I feel to be a necessity. I think in Islamic Republic only, that was the only place that they shut down these sacred places.
Yeah.
For the sake of the test, okay, we did this, right? It made the people, I'm not a policymaker to say that policy, what was the reason behind that policy.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, they noticed that the shrines must be open.
I just wanted to ask you, Brother Mahdi, do we have to hold these religious gatherings? Like, for example, Arba'een procession.
I believe it's a necessity. For me, I can't live without visiting Karbala. I can't live without visiting the shrines of Lady Masuma. I can't live without going to Masjid. I can't live without going to Masjid. That's part of my life. That's a necessity of mine. And that's how do we respect, in the United States,
mm-hmm,
how come we respect the choice of people who decide to go unvaccinated because they do not believe in vaccination? I think it's a matter of respecting the choice. But am I going to impose it to others? No, that's my right. Lady Masuma, for example, her shrine is for everyone. That's
mm-hmm,
my right to visit her. Well, social distancing, place it on as a policy. Put it inside the harem so people visit the shrine with social distancing.
But a lot
do
of
this,
scientists say otherwise. They let's say, argue against your view that they say that in most of these public gatherings, in fact, they see more of these, let's say, whatchamacallit, infection going on, you know?
Well, that's what I was saying
not
like back in the United States. I said to people, don't go to Costco,
mm-hmm.
right? Don't go to Costco from tomorrow on. Why is the masjid is closed down?
Yeah, they don't differentiate between the two. They don't say only the religious gathering. They say every kind of gathering.
That's my point of view.
That's the philosophy behind all the quarantines that was going on, in fact, in every corner of the world, you know?
Sure. Except for Brother Muhammad Jawad, when when this virus first started, the first thing that popped up to my mind was, why are we shutting down everything? I was against the idea of, you know, quarantine. I was also against the idea of starting research for vaccine. I was with the idea of searching for medicine.
Thank you very much, Brother Habib and Brother Mahdi, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. I'm Ahmad Javad, signing off. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On life support, in tatters, and on the verge of collapse. These are some of the terms that have been used to describe the current status of the hard-earned nuclear deal that emerged in 2015 after so many rounds of painstaking diplomacy between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries. The deal is almost dead, with the U.S. having abandoned it, the European parties failing to abide by their commitments or make up for the damage from the U.S. withdrawal, and Iran having rolled back some of its commitments. Who's to blame for the status quo? Many point the finger at former American President Donald Trump and his favorite maximum pressure policy involving a long list of anti-Iran sanctions. His successor, Joe Biden, a vociferous critic of Trump's confrontational approach, has insisted that he wants to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But after taking office in January, his administration has enforced every single sanction that the former president imposed against the Iranians. This has led Iran to doubt Biden's seriousness. Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, between April and June to find a path back into compliance with the deal. But critics say the Biden administration missed that window of opportunity by refusing to make up for America's unilateral withdrawal and provide proper assurances that it will not violate the deal again. Despite this, the involved parties are going to give diplomacy another chance with a new round of talks scheduled to take place later this month. Discussions are set to resume in Vienna next week. Top negotiators from Iran, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany will sit down for talks again. U.S. representatives will also be in the city, but not in the same room, as Iranians won't directly talk to the party that unilaterally withdrew from the international deal. What are the talks' chances of success? Iran says to be successful, the dialogue must lead to the removal of sanctions. Tehran also insists that America must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the deal again. The U.S. has repeatedly rejected Iranian demands for such guarantees. How is the U.S. planning to deal with its seriously damaged credibility? The head of Iran's permanent mission to the international organizations in Vienna said this week that the United States should prove its goodwill by removing sanctions against Tehran. During a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors, he said that the credible and effective lifting of sanctions is the basis of Iran's willingness to abide by the terms of the agreement. He said it is unfortunate that European countries still do not want to openly condemn the unilateral withdrawal of the United States and the reimposition of sanctions, which is the only cause of all current problems.
First of all, in order to understand Europe, you have to understand the European Union. To understand the European Union, you have to understand it is under the control of Germany. Germany is a vassal state of the United States of America. Germany was conquered after World War II, where they lost the war, and they have been a vassal state ever since that time. The vassal does not tell the sovereign what to do. That's why they're not arguing with the United States. The United States tells them what to do, not the other way around.
It is definitely hard to guess what direction the talks will take, but the next meeting could shed light on how the two sides will approach the discussions.
Every year on the fourth Thursday of November in the United States, people hold ceremonies to celebrate Thanksgiving. The annual Thanksgiving holiday tradition in the U.S. goes back to when English settlers arrived at U.S. coasts. The landing was followed by a religious celebration by the settlers, but it proved disastrous for the indigenous people living there. It was just the beginning of pillage perpetrated in the service of European expansionism. Native Americans were greatly affected by the European colonization of the Americas. The annual celebration has come to symbolize the genocide of Native Americans.
The day known as Thanksgiving has extremely racist origins in the United States. It's a holiday marked by the U.S. government that represents the genocide, the enslavement of indigenous peoples. It was marked as a celebration of the bloodshed of Native Americans on their own land by white settlers from Europe who settled on this land.
Many believe Thanksgiving, marking the birth of the U.S., leaves out painful truths about the nation's history. Presenting Thanksgiving to children as primarily a happy time trivializes the trials and tribulations of the continent's indigenous population. The United American Indians of New England meet each year at Plymouth Rock on the Coles Hill to mourn.
To this day, there are indigenous peoples who are being pushed out of their lands in the United States. The Navajo Nation, Apache Nation, the Chumash Nation, the Iroquois Nation, all across the United States, indigenous peoples are still resisting and fighting the settler colonial project known as the United States.
They gather to remember and reflect in the hope that America will never forget the sacrifices and tragedies of its native people. The United American Indians of New England declared Thanksgiving a national day of mourning 50 years ago. It is a day of remembrance and spiritual connection, as well as a protest of the racism and oppression which Native Americans continue to experience to this day.
So the roots of Thanksgiving are actually a celebration of a massacre of innocent women and young children and families who were on their lands and were brutally murdered in horrific ways by these foreigners who came from England, from Holland, from other European nations. And at its core, this represents the foundation of the U.S. imperialist system, of the United States as a nation, as a country.
Native Americans have endured genocide, discrimination, the abduction of their children, deliberate infection with smallpox, forced labor, and other abuses inflicted on them by their non-indigenous oppressors. They were banished by the 1830 Indian Removal Act to largely barren reservations of the American West, and they have remained invisible to the rest of the country ever since. In the U.S. today, Native American households are 19 times as likely as white households to lack indoor plumbing. African Americans and Latin Americans are twice as likely. Some Native American families have to drive an hour or more to retrieve fresh water.
Discrimination against indigenous peoples on the United States remains extremely rampant. Right now, as we speak, indigenous peoples are the poorest nation, the poorest communities of all other groups. They have the highest level of poverty, even compared to Black and Latino communities in the U.S. Indigenous peoples have no sovereignty over their land. They're forced to live on reservations, what they call them, which are huge concentration camps where there is oftentimes no running water, no clean infrastructure, no connectivity to the outside world, very few hospitals, very few schools.
The 300,000 members of the Navajo Nation, which spans New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, represent 75% of all households in the U.S. living without electricity. The vulnerability of Native Americans to COVID-19 is disproportionately high compared with other populations.
Poverty, discrimination, a lack of health care, lack of education, lack of proper housing, and even worse is repression of indigenous peoples through police brutality, through the military-industrial complex, through violence. One of the biggest issues that has plagued indigenous communities in the United States are work sites, mining sites, backed by these huge European banks.
Poor health amongst Native Americans is caused by many contributing factors, including high rates of poverty, isolated geography, poor education and nutrition, inadequate sewage disposal, unhealthy living conditions, to name a few. Alcoholism is chronic and widespread, spanning all age groups, and heroin use among some tribes is 4 times higher than elsewhere. The serious issues with mental health among Native Americans are closely linked to other risk factors. Native Americans have the highest unemployment rates across the country. All of these problems that were just mentioned are a result of the U.S. and its takeover of Native Americans and their land, which to this day, Native Americans are suffering as a consequence.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets in major cities across the country on Monday to denounce the U.S. complicity in the protracted Saudi war on the Arab country. The biggest rally was held in the northwestern city of Sada, where thousands carrying Yemeni flags and chanting anti-American and anti-Saudi slogans poured into the streets. The protesters say Washington is behind the military and economic war on the nation and is prolonging the war and siege of Yemen. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, a senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, says the United States spearheads the devastating Saudi-led military aggression and brutal siege against his country, stating that Washington is complicit in the crimes that the Riyadh regime is committing against the Yemeni nation. He said the U.S. has been killing Yemeni people and destroying vital infrastructure for the past 7 years, stressing that the Riyadh regime and its regional allies would not have been able to do anything without Washington's support.
We saw in the last days only Saudi Arabia carried out in one day 65 attacks on different civilian targets in Yemen. This is how we see the Americans' complicity, because they do nothing to stop the Saudi war. On the contrary, they encourage this war to continue.
The organizers of the protest said in a statement that Washington was misleading the world about its stance toward Yemen. The statement said the administration of President Joe Biden continues to provide Riyadh and its regional allies with military and political support, enabling them to press ahead with their onslaught and commit crimes against the people of Yemen.
This war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The U.S. president made the pledge back in February this year. He touted the move as part of efforts to restore an emphasis on human rights. Biden, however, said Washington will continue to support and help Riyadh. The peace activists who hailed his announcement are now dismayed at his administration for going back on the promise. Back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. A State Department spokesperson defended the sale as, quote, fully consistent with the administration's pledge to lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen.
We see that there is no will to end this war on Yemen. Moreover, we see also the Americans are not asking the Saudis to lift the siege on the Yemeni harbor and the Yemeni airport in Sana'a. Therefore, they are the direct contributor of the siege imposed on the population of Yemen.
President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he's staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. Wouldn't that embolden those officials to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in the most literal sense?
The Genoa U.S. Indian Industrial School, a government-run boarding school for Native Americans located on the edge of town in Genoa, Nebraska. Decades after its closure in 1934, researchers have unearthed the bleak history of this institution. They confirmed that over 100 Native American children died at this school, using newspaper archives and school newsletters to identify them, because official records were destroyed when the school closed. Search for the graves of children is in progress at the site of the Genoa school. Researchers said the true death toll is probably much higher. The passing of the Civilization Fund Act in 1819 by the U.S. Congress authorized the government to establish residential boarding schools and relocate Native American children by force. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of children were sent to boarding schools operated by the government or churches across the U.S. However, some never returned home. Students were victims of harsh punishments and hard labor, and many of them died of diseases. One descendant claimed his great-grandmother was blinded while a student at Genoa, probably by having lye soap rubbed into her eyes as punishment. While they were removed from their families and homeland, children were prohibited from speaking tribal languages in a bid to subdue or eliminate the Native American culture. The narrative has an uncanny resemblance to Canada's residential school system. In the 19th century, Canada also established mandatory boarding schools for Indigenous children. 150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against children. This year, remains of 215 First Nation children were discovered at the site of a former residential school near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded that the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners through the 20th century.
And just imagine this, somebody coming to your home and taking your children from you when they're 5 years old, 4 years old, and taking them away, and away from your influence, away from your understanding, away from your culture. That's what happens to Indigenous people in the United States and in Canada.
One of the tactics used by the U.S. federal government to destroy the culture, religion, and way of life of Native Americans was the establishment of boarding schools. The discovery in Genoa school is only a tiny part of the immense hardship colonial settlers inflicted on Native Americans. Back in the late 1700s, American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. When Christopher Columbus reached the Americas in 1492, 10 million indigenous people lived in what is now the United States. By 1900, there were less than 300,000. Another atrocity against Native people in America is the implementation of the Indian Removal Act. In 1830, the U.S. federal government endowed itself with the right to take Native-held land east of Mississippi and forcibly relocate Native people from their homes in Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, Florida, and Tennessee to Indian territory in what is now Oklahoma. In a mass atrocity remembered as the Trail of Tears, tens of thousands of Native Americans died or were killed after fleeing their homes in terror.
The immigrants never had any land when they got here, and whatever they got in terms of land, they stole.
Native Americans were expelled from the lands they had lived in for generations. They were victims of wars, mass killings, and discriminations while the U.S. government destroyed their cultural traditions. Even today, discrimination and oppression against minorities exists in the U.S., as racial discrimination is systematic in American society.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the COVID-19 pandemic upended the economy in the spring and summer of 2020, tens of millions of Americans lost their jobs and became ever more vulnerable to hunger. In consequence, the country's network of food banks saw a sudden spike in surge. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sasha Bromsky, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Food Insecurity is Much Higher Than Before COVID. As the COVID pandemic upended the economy in the spring and summer of 2020, tens of millions of Americans lost their jobs and became ever more vulnerable to hunger. In consequence, the country's network of food banks saw a sudden spike in usage. Just prior to and at the start of the pandemic, food banks distributed 1.1 billion pounds of food in the first quarter of 2020. By the fall of that year, they were handing out 1.7 billion pounds. Since then, that dizzying increase has leveled off or fallen somewhat in many places. But that doesn't mean the country is no longer suffering an epidemic of food insecurity. To the contrary, large food banks around the country are still reporting far higher levels of food and of food distribution to attempt to meet that need than was the case prior to COVID. In Washington, D.C., for example, the big food banks are reporting an increase in usage of more than 60% compared to 2019. Put simply, as Thanksgiving rolls around again, millions of Americans are struggling to feed their families the bare minimum on a daily basis. If they are able to have a bigger spread, it will likely be only thanks to food charities and their volunteers and donors. Meanwhile, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, enrollment is up by 7 million compared to 2 years ago, with more than 42 million Americans now on food stamps. Of these, more than 4 in 10 are members of families with at least one person working. Throughout much of the South, upward of 15% of residents receive SNAP assistance. In New Mexico, the state with the highest rate of food stamp usage in the country, more than 1 in 5 residents are enrolled in SNAP. Looked at one way, these numbers and the resilience of SNAP in the face of long-standing conservative antipathy to the program are success stories. Tens of millions of Americans do not have enough economic security to easily feed themselves and their families. But thankfully, the country does not have an epidemic of starvation. Instead, its charitable networks have gone into overdrive, and a food distribution mechanism has been fine-tuned to keep hunger at bay for the vast majority of recipients. At the same time, SNAP has become the de facto story of an otherwise withered social safety net. Looked at another way, however, these numbers are a devastating indictment of the current U.S. economic model. In the world's richest country, with more billionaires than anywhere else on Earth, a large percentage of the population lacks the ability to set aside the financial resources to be able to easily feed themselves and their children. Instead, they have to fall back either on charity or on government assistance. Many people who rely on food aid have jobs, just not jobs that pay enough of a living wage to allow them to buy food for their families. In the South in particular, where in few places does the local minimum wage exceed the federal minimum of $7.25 per hour, less than half what it is in cities and states that move toward the $15 per hour living wage in recent years, the scandal of food insecurity for the working poor remains omnipresent. This is a crisis in the United States, magnified, though by no means created, by the pandemic, not of food production failures, but of skyrocketing inequality. There is clearly no shortage of food in the U.S., but there is a shortage of disposable income among a growing percentage of people at the bottom of the economy. Americans have, as a society, become inured to the stunning realities of families experiencing shortages of food amid a broader glut of staples. As the U.S. gears up to celebrate a holiday that for many people revolves around copious feasting with family and friends, that crisis has been exacerbated months of high inflation, especially in key sectors of the economy such as fuel and food. Some meats have increased in prices by nearly 10% this past year. More worryingly, this summer, in several food categories such as eggs, prices began escalating by 3% per month. If that continues for a significant period of time, it will have massive impacts on the purchasing power of poor Americans, who already spend a vastly disproportionate part of their limited income on food. While the average amount of disposable personal income that Americans spend on food for preparing at home declined from 13.7% in 1960 to 5.7% in 2000, as incomes rose and as food costs declined, this has never held for poor Americans. In fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates from 5 years ago found that the poorest quintile of Americans were still spending between 28 and 42% of their pre-tax income on food. Given that low-income Americans are also being particularly hard hit by surges in prices for housing, fuel, and a range of consumer goods such as used cars, the inflationary trends with the food industry threaten to render their economic tightrope walk even more dangerous. As a result, even as the overall unemployment rate has returned to near pre-pandemic levels, with latest Bureau of Labor Statistics data showing 4.6% unemployment, even as overall poverty rates have gone down to nearly historically low levels due to huge levels of government intervention in the economy, food insecurity remains prevalent in the United States of America.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a short part of some articles about Imam Khomeini's point of view on religion and politics. Religion, in Imam Khomeini's viewpoint, guarantees salvation and perfection of humankind. Man should always be pious in its true sense of the term in order to reach his final goal, which is having position of esteem in front of Allah. In other words, Islam, as the most complete religion that pays attention all aspects of human existence, whether material or spiritual. In the Imam's viewpoint, Islam's great value and richness is indubitable, and all that one needs to reach salvation in his life and the life hereafter is provided in divine decrees and the Holy Quran. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, he has PhD on Islamic science.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search of Islam. Imam Khomeini, in one of his sayings, he has said that we rose up all together to revive Islam here and hopefully to export it to other places. Now, this is very interesting that when Imam Khomeini is talking about the Islam and the revolution, he talks about the reviving the Islam in his own country where he resides, and also exporting the true Islam. Why? Because we can see in today's world, the rebels, the enemies of Islam, they are trying to propagate an Islamic version which they think of, and which has nothing to do with the true teachings of Islam. And Imam Khomeini said that it is our duty to export the true Islam. We can also see that in a couple of years back, when there was the issue of ISIS, we can see the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, also wrote two letters to the youth of the West. And that had exactly the same statements as what Imam Khomeini has. And he said that you must take the religion from the original source. And that original source is Quran itself. It looks like we are away from the true Islam. We are away from the teachings of the Quran, where the Quran itself gives us the honor. Following the Quran gives us the respect, and it makes us noble. Ya Rabbana, salli ala. We need to follow the true Islam. And Imam Khomeini has said that this Islamic revolution was happened so that we can have Islam, revive Islam in this place where we live, and also to export it to the other places. Because if we are not exporting the true Islam, then obviously the people will not get aware of this Islam. And then the Islamophobia will spread. We can see the issues that we have in the West. The wrong picture of Islam is being showed, and Islam, which is the religion of love, religion of peace, will be changed to the religion of something else. So inshallah, may Allah help us to revive the Islam in its true way and to follow it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.